podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. After we spent a lot of last week's show bemoaning England's lack of rotation and deviation from Plan A, the tables have turned somewhat, with the ECB calling up an entirely new squad led by Ben Stokes for the Pakistan ODIs after seven members of their ODI party tested positive for COVID-19. We'll be talking about that, the end of the Sri Lanka and India series, the latest round of the County Championship and much more. I'm Yaz Rana, and on today's show I'm joined by the managing editor of Wisden.com, Ben Gardner, the editor-in-chief of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Phil Walker, and former England cricketer, Mark Butcher. Phil, before we get into the squad that was called up, was Tuesday morning a bit of a reality check for the English game, with a lot of cricket still to be played this summer?
Yeah, it's probably a good way of putting it. They had no choice but to act and take the nuclear option. I think it was absolutely the right call. I think they spoke to one or two experts, you know, medical experts and so on, and they were all in agreement that they had to act and act quickly. Giles said it's on a knife edge. He said exactly the same phrase this time last summer. And any notions that we are, you know, out of the woods and that we can afford to relax, as our esteemed leaders down the road at Westminster are kind of encouraging us to. Well, I think we've seen the folly of that this week. The ECB have necessarily, in order to protect the game, been kind of behind they've kind of lined up behind changes within society, you know, necessarily so, because they are protecting a game that is absolutely desperate for this kind of revenue, as we know, and the show has to go on, come what may. So they made this decision, and it was absolutely the right one.
Ben, we've talked about before how the situation this summer is completely different, and just a far harder task actually creating a biosecure bubble than last summer. The health secretary literally said earlier this week to expect 100,000 cases a day later this summer. Last summer, when England were playing West Indies, Pakistan, it was about 1,000 cases nationwide a day. It's a completely different task facing the ECB, and they're not going about it in exactly the same way as last year, for understandable reasons, but you know, you can see how something like this could happen and could happen again.
Yeah, they're in a really tricky situation. But yeah, there was a lot of sort of congratulation last year over the security of that bio bubble. And in hindsight, I mean, I don't think there's actually been in cricket, at least, a bio bubble that has kind of stayed intact in a country where COVID cases have been that high. We saw it happen in South Africa, we saw it happen in India, where in the IPL, where eventually something is just going to give, basically. But then also, I think they've rightly recognised the strain on players' mental health that being in these sort of enclosed environments does create, and have kind of felt that that's not going to be almost feasible this summer. So they do have to take, like, slightly relax it. They would say it's not too much, but still they're not playing at grounds all the time where there are hotels attached to the grounds. There's just that little bit more insecurity there that gets introduced. And then also there's so much more kind of valuable cricket to be played this summer. Like they postponed the 100 last year to give it the best go this year. And, you know, they'll be able to get crowds in, which they wouldn't be able to last year. So from that point of view, it'll look like a good thing. But if you know, there's an outbreak within a team, say, and it's a much harder thing to get sort of another sort of 15 county cricketers in and then keep the integrity of that competition and not have it become sort of something that's instantly diminished in its first tournament. So yeah, it's a really tricky situation. I'd be surprised, basically, if this was the last we hear of it. I think I saw something saying the India team are all getting their second jabs this week. So it might be that in that series, possibly, there can be a little bit more sort of that a COVID case, even, say, in the middle of a test match, doesn't need to be the end of a whole game. Maybe they'll make things slightly stricter by having sort of bubbles within bubbles and that sort of thing, so they can isolate close contacts. I mean, because that's the other thing in this, is it wasn't just one player getting, or one support staff member getting a case, and then they've taken this. It was seven, so it was kind of within the whole group, and there was like, but it might have been that if it had just been one, they could have just removed sort of five players that they recognise as close contacts and then brought a few in, and it wouldn't have been so sort of dramatic, the move. So yeah, this is worrying, but Also, this is like, in a way, the worst case apart from it not being the most high profile series. And we're still, looks like we're going to get a game on. So,
you know, the interesting thing about all of this is that everything is very, very different from last year. They're not in biosecure bubbles, the teams. They're staying in hotels that the general public is staying in. They're not locked away. Nothing is the same as it was then. Yes, we have vaccines. Yes, there are crowds in the grounds. I was at Wembley last night, walking down Wembley Way with 60,000 people, all penned in, nobody wearing masks. I mean, it's kind of, you know, the cases are going to go up. They're going to go through the roof. Whether it will mean that there are as many people hospitalized or dying is the job of the vaccines to kind of just from stopping that from happening. But if you were a touring team, i.e. Pakistan or India, sort of semi-locked away, if you like, the country is raging with cases, there is the chance that a match could be stopped halfway through, they would be forgiven for doing what England did in South Africa and getting the hell out of Dodge.
Yeah.
And that this for me is the key. You know, the reason England and Australia and the other financially or more financially secure countries, I should say, kind of have the luxury of being able to pick and choose where they want to stay and where they want to play. Whereas Pakistan are desperate for teams to go to Pakistan. So they won't, you know, they'll be put in a dilemma where they might decide to kind of use their players a little bit as not guinea pigs, not the right word, but, you know, say to their players, well, you know, we're going to have to take the chances on your safety because we need to make sure that there's a reciprocal series coming up later on. And that's a problem. The whole thing creates a massive, massive issue. Now, if England had been on tour in... If the shoe had been on the other foot and England had been on tour in Pakistan and the entire Pakistan team went down and they said, oh, we're going to have to replace the whole team, England would have gone.
They're behind by now. Yeah.
Over. Right? So, you know, this is... We're on very, very shaky ground here, I feel, because it only takes another issue to happen. It only takes another huge spike. It only takes for one of the members of the Pakistan touring team to get COVID. Three or four of them go down. They can't replace the whole team, and the whole thing's over. I don't blame. There's no blame attached to any of this stuff. But the reality of it is that cases are going up. The restrictions or the safeguards that were in place last year are no longer in place, and so you're going to end up with people getting COVID. And that's the reality of it.
The Guardian have crunched the numbers and looked at the data and assessed the likelihood that it's going to be up to 10 million people are going to have to self-isolate in the next 6 weeks, right? Now, if those numbers are correct, or even broadly correct, that's one in six people in the UK. It's highly likely that if we're talking just in our little pocket of the world, that a lot of so-called big cricket will be disrupted going down the line. You know, England have got away with this because of the depth of their talent pool and because of the fact that they are at home and they can call people up literally overnight. But as Mark says,
only because Pakistan have not as yet said, "Whoa, hang on a sec, we're out of here."
Sure,
that's the only reason. The rest of it kind of doesn't matter whether we can replace this, you know, whether one of the new lot of the nine uncapped players, because they're coming in from bubbles that aren't secure too. You know, they've been going back to their families and backwards and forwards playing for their counties and things like that. So, you know, they're coming from unsafe, in inverted commas, environments to go and join up with the England team, whose bubble will be slightly stricter than the one that they've come from Gloucestershire or wherever they've come from. You know, at some point, you run out of players, or at some point, the opposition go, hang on a second, we're out of here. This is not right. You guys wouldn't be doing it if it was the other way around, and we're going to have to go.
Yeah, Phil, what do you make of accusations of double standards? Ramiz Raja tweeted something along those lines yesterday. How close do you think Pakistan were, do you think, from going home?
I can't say. I don't know. I know that they're owed a huge debt by the ECB, and I hope that it's repaid with a touring team within the next 18 months to Pakistan. And I hope that the players as well recognise that there is a spirit of altruism here that was evident last summer and hopefully, fingers crossed, can continue through this summer. I don't know how close they would have been. I can't say. Mark is absolutely right. The double standards, the whiff of hypocrisy is glaring. Now, the one caveat I would maybe add about the South Africa balls up back in October, November last year is that we didn't know as much, and there was a understandable hysteria around it, and I can understand the players' desire to get out and to get home last winter. But the problem is that position, that kind of ethical position, it starts to look a wee bit flimsy when you consider now that as Mark says, the shoe's on the other foot.
Ben, on the actual squad itself, England picked 6 players who've never played for England before in any format, 9 who've not played ODI cricket. What are the names that leap out for you?
What names don't leap out? I mean, it's as I said at the beginning, I mean, we were all sort of saying, why can't England pick a few new players? Why can't it be a bit more exciting? Do they need to sort of test themselves a bit more? Well, like...
Spare thought for George Garton.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Will Jacks is the one that's sort of in the blast. Look, he looks sort of... I mean, it's not like he's getting runs week after week, but when he's on form, he sort of hits it as cleanly as anyone in the country, basically. I'm intrigued by the prospect of Zach Crawley in ODI cricket. You wonder if he might well be at some point a very good all-format player for England, but if right now his game is best suited to white ball cricket, where he can sort of hit through the line, where he doesn't have to sort of dig in through those sort of really tough periods where he can just sort of play a bit freely. And I think it might be worth a discussion. I don't know, maybe wait until we see how he does. But if he were to get runs in this series, I wonder if that would impact his prospect of keeping his place for that India series or not. I think I would be tempted, hypothetically, if he were to get a score and sort of look back to his sort of fluent self, to give him just one more game to see if that's the thing that has sort of ticked him into being the player he was last summer. Because he, at his best, will be a weapon in Australia in particular, where the ball doesn't move around as much. And England should be kind of doing, I think, almost whatever they can. And that would be a sort of an understandable sort of a sacrifice in a way to their chances against India, where you might have a player who was slightly more likely to get runs or face a few more balls against India. But if Zach Crawley can do that and then be back in form to play Australia, that would be huge, I think.
On the ODI squad, though.
Sorry.
there'll be some players in that group who a lot of fans actually might not have heard of or heard much about. So,
well, you got more Twitter followers than David Payne, don't you, Az?
Yeah, that's true. Bryden Cass, David Payne, John Simpson are probably the three that fans might not have not been that close to England squads.
Well, Bryden Cass has got genuine pace.
Mm.
Saw him up at Durham. Yeah, he's, very, very handy. Get the ball through, bowls a decent Yorker at the death. He's very highly thought of up there.
He played a bit for the Lions as well, did well in Australia last.
Yeah. I mean, he's got that strength of action and ability to kind of make a ball leap out of a flashy surface that's very handy with a Kookaburra ball in Aussie conditions. So that's good. Beyond that, so recalls, sort of recalls to England rather than recalls for one day internationals for guys like Ben Duckett, who gets a chance to kind of put his name back up there as being one of the more talented players knocking around. Matt Parkinson, I thought the whole George Garton thing not playing, it was really interesting. The pre-match interview that Owen Morgan gave with Rob Key in the last ODI against Sri Lanka, where he was asked about sort of not putting in George Garton with the series, one, and although of course every match is worth 10 points, which is another reason where Pakistan might not be keen to go home just quietly. They might think to themselves, we can pick up 3 Super Cup points here and then hightail it out of here. But anyway, that's another story. George Garton not getting a game. Owen Morgan said, we want to have these guys around the squad a little bit more, which they do. Absolutely, he's absolutely consistent. Like to have them around, see how they're getting on, see how they blend in before they throw them in. He said, and we like to give them a softer entry into the team as we possibly can. And I'm kind of like standing there waiting to do the top of the show game. Well, I mean, it doesn't get much softer than this right now. Sri Lanka at home with all their batting woes. They didn't play him. And of course, now that's it. He's out of the reckoning for these ones, which is a shame for him.
And Tom Banton as well, just a line on him. I mean, how's your luck?
I know.
Pulled out the BBL, citing, fatigue, bubble fatigue, mental strain, understandably so. Pulled out of that. Couldn't buy a run for a couple of months.
Yeah.
Made a brilliant 47 ball 100 or whatever on the telly. Back in the mix. And then what, 48 hours later, he's got to self-isolate again and...
kicking his heels, not playing any cricket, you know, and that form could just disappear down the drain once again. So, I mean, you know, it's a real shame. Phil Salt, I mean, he's another guy who I think has improved quite a lot. I mean, he was very much a leg-sided dasher the first time I saw him two or three seasons ago. His game has improved no end, and he's still got that sort of, you know, real sort of sparky stroke play at the top of the order. So he's another one who could impress for people who perhaps aren't, you know, who aren't followers of Sussex, who don't recognise... don't recognise his name straight off the bat.
Saul's coach at Sussex. Yeah, he would say this, but he said he's one of the most talented players he's ever seen, Phil Salt, as a ball striker. As Mark says, you know, he's a bit rough around the edges, but he'll be very watchable if he gets in.
Tom Helm, people have spoken about as well in the last two or three. So I think he's perhaps gone off the boil a little bit, or people have kind of sussed him out a touch, white ball-wise. I mean, you know, his performances this year kind of disappear into the mire of Middlesex's woeful seasons. It's a bit difficult to judge him on this season as opposed to the ones that have gone before. See somebody else who's decent. I can't see too many of them, though. You know, with the exception of names like Milan, who's already in and around, Saqib Mahmood, who's already been in and around, guys who are kind of going to do well in this series and keep out the regulars. Not many. Parkinson's probably, you know, is another guy who, given an injury to Adil Rashid, England need that. They'd want to replace the middle over wicket taking leg spinner with a middle over wicket taking leg spinner, as part of their sort of remit for success in 50 over cricket. So, you know, him getting the chance to play three games is excellent for him and excellent for England too.
Mm. Ben,
yeah, we were asked, I think, on Twitter about who are the players who could sort of force themselves into the reckoning. Obviously, England have a very settled, especially batting lineup. I think the bowling attack in T20 cricket is slightly more sort of fluid at the moment. So that would be the place where someone like a Brydon Carstens as a keeper mood could sort of put their hand up and force their way out of the pecking order a bit. I mean, Morgan even, I think he name-checked Amal Mills in a press conference a while ago, saying that that's the kind of player he'd be looking out for in the 100 to see if they can make a break. But this is as good a chance as that. But yeah, I think Phil Salt is the one you know, it's one of those buzzwords, isn't it? That intent that they talk about, just being fearless and sort of attacking from ball one, that is so important to England in ODI cricket. And he's one, I mean, he maybe should have been selected for that Ireland series last year. He made a brilliant 100 in the warm-ups against a pretty full-strength Ireland side. And if there were to be a player, especially if... But basically, he looks like the heir to Bairstow and Roy from what he's done in county cricket so far. And this is a chance to see if he can do it in international cricket, and then at some point further down the line, if one of them loses a bit of form or needs a rest or whatever it may be, he's one I think that could really press his claims in this series, I think.
Just to add, you mentioned Ben Duckett, 69 not out in a first class game and then whipped out, midway through it. I mean, counties are conditioned to this, you know, and I think they know their place in the overall scheme of things, and obviously we are living in particularly surreal times anyway, but what's happened here, unprecedented as it is, again, we touched on it last week, talk about the kink in the schedules. So Daniel Lawrence now won't play a red ball game between from the time he nicked off defending to extra cover at Edgbaston in what, early to mid-June, to the first week in August. So 7 weeks, no red ball cricket at all, won't hit a red ball.
If then, even if selected, you know.
Yeah, obviously, if selected, yeah. And it just goes to show, I mean, you know, this is a ludicrous situation where England's potential number 5-6 won't hit a red ball in anger for 2 months going into a marquee test series. Look, we talked about it. We know it's ridiculous, but this has really, really drawn it into focus. At least he'd have had a game on Sunday, a red ball game under normal circumstances, but no.
Zach Crawley as well, for that matter.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess... Yeah, he won't feature either, yeah.
Not that it's helped the guys who are in possession anyway. They've made sum total of about 7 runs between them in the last
if
round.
That, yeah, if
we
that.
Should, we should come to that, shouldn't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, we will. Giles actually made a point to thank the directors of cricket across the country for how supportive they were of the last-minute dash.
I was actually interviewing Neil Colleen at Durham, the Durham coach, the morning that it was all going off, and the conversation changed tone very, very quickly. He was really chipper. Yeah, now we've got to bat 4 sessions and try and bowl them out the final day. To, I'm gonna have to go. and you can just hear this chaos in the background. What's happened, of course, is obviously Stokes is being whipped out firing line and thrown back down the M1.
What do you think it would have been like for Giles? Giles kind of intimated he didn't get a whole lot of sleep. Chris Hillwood's had to cancel his holiday.
He was in Norfolk, wasn't he, on the boards?
Exactly.
Brutal.
What do you think that 12-hour period would have been like for England? And also, how do you actually go about picking entirely... second string side.
That must have been fun. Picking an entirely new squad.
I get that, you know, the Ben Dockett, Dan Milan, James Vincent, yeah, they played for England recently. But, you know, how do you know who your 12th best seamer
is? Well, I mean, that's why he's the supremo of everything, Chris Silverwood. I'm guessing the conversation would have gone something like this. You know what? I've had enough of being chief of selectors. we need to give that job back to somebody else who does that and does that on its own.
Well, it's harder than it looks, isn't it?
Well, I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, there are some people, obviously, who didn't make it that we haven't mentioned. Obviously, Alex Hales doesn't get into the third team.
Yeah.
which tells you all you need to know about how close he is to being rehabilitated into the squad, which is nowhere.
Can I ask you on the Hales thing? I don't know if we've done it that much. You've been inside dressing rooms. Do you understand where Morgan's coming from in terms of the team dynamic?
All I will say to you is this, that there is more than is known about all of this. That's all. That's all. I kind of have an inkling of what it is. I'm not going to say on this. It's not my place. But his omission is clearly nothing to do with how good a player he is. It's clearly not just to do with failed drug tests on the eve of World Cups, which when you say it out loud, you go, Jesus Christ, did he really do that? Yes, he did. But there may be one or two other things in there as well for which he may never be forgiven, I think. And that's all you're getting.
Fair enough.
I would, on Hales, I mean, I can sort of see how this feels strange that he doesn't make a second string team in England and, you know, in dire need, basically. But I don't think his non-selection for this actually... I mean, it might well be that he never plays for England again. That's already decided and they just haven't said it kind of thing. But I don't think his non-selection for this exactly makes much odds one way or the other. I think that actually picking Alex Hales... Like, when everything is already chaos and there's already, like, you know, there's going to be questions asked of the ECB over their bicycle protocols about how seriously they're taking this whole thing about, you know, so many other things. To introduce the extra thing of, like, you know, one of your two senior players being Alex Hales... And having that whole extra other news story when already you're sort of
Ben
fighting
Stokes
fire,
is his captain.
that's pouring oil onto the whole thing. I think so. I can see why, even if you think.
Well, yeah, I know, like, I get that, but these are not as I alluded to before, not insignificant matches. You know, there are points involved in them and qualification for World Cups involved in them. So they're not. You know, you'd still, given that you're having to literally put 9 uncapped players in your squad, you'd want to have some people that you might be able to guarantee some performance out of. So I'd be less, normally I'd agree with you, but I don't now.
Sam Hain.
I was about to say,
Sam Hain.
A lot of people have been asking about him, but he's got the highest list A average of all time, of course, but I kind of see why he's not been picked, because you go through that top six, is likely to play. And
he does not play in the way that Owen Morgan wants his top six to play.
Well, there's kind of like one spot for the root anchor role, where an anchor who strikes at 90, but there's kind of like one spot for that in the side. And Milan surely gets that. Milan's done well in ODI cricket. We said before on the show that ODI cricket might actually be his best format.
Yeah.
And you can only really have space for one of them in the squad. So I kind of understand it. It's harsh on him. He's also not played List A game for two and a bit years, like everyone. So it's quite hard to pick on List A form.
Yeah, it was interesting you saying what would it have been like in that sort of that Giles Silverwood sort of mind cave kind of thing, as they were like desperately trying to think of 18 county players. Because there's already been the slight sense with some of Silverwood selections that he doesn't, like, you know, he's not one of these sort of these money ball, looking at like the deep T20 stats types, possibly, that, like, he's kind of, when he's looking to fill out a squad, he's thinking like, oh, who's sort of been in and around squads recently? Oh, Chris Wokes, is he quite a good white ball bowler? And he's like, actually, he hasn't played at all since 2015, but don't that stop you. And obviously he is very good. I'm not saying that was the wrong thing to do, but that's just what the sense of those selections is. And then you almost wonder if there was a stage at, like, you know, midday on that day when people are sort of asking, like, where's this guy in the squad? And where's this guy in the squad? And if they've ever just, like, sort of hit their heads and go, oh, balls, how did we forget about Alex Davies of Lancashire? He's it would be great. And I'd love to read or see, if only they were doing a fly on the wall documentary this year, that'd be a, an incredible episode of TV.
Also, this will be the most likely instance of someone genuinely thinking it was a prank when they got a phone call from Chris Silverwood. Ben, these games form part of the ODI World Cup Super League that determined World Cup qualification. If England lose this, are they in any danger of not qualifying automatically?
I mean, they've got a series against the Netherlands, which I guess they'll hope to clean sweep, but you never know if there could be rain to play a part, and they have lost to the Netherlands in the past. So yeah, England aren't guaranteed, and I think that there could be a danger if they lose this one 3-0. But it's hard to know how much this is. I mean, I don't think it's playing a huge amount in fans thinking, judging from the Sri Lanka series, how, you know, that wasn't at all a factor, I think, in most people thinking that England should rotate or not. People like, you know, pick some new players and hopefully we'll win it anyway. But
I mean, the interesting thing with that was it was like pick one player. You know, people talking about this, like, you know, I remember we had the conversation on the TV, Athers and I, you know, we sort of went into the context of it, you know, the softness of the game, you know, that Owen Morgan already mentioned, you know, the fact that it would have been, you know, the perfect time to give a young lad like George Galton a debut in a series, in a game and a match that you're very, very much unlikely to lose. But we got hit by torrents of people going, well, you know, you can't just hand out one day international caps like confetti and all this kind of stuff. Like, mate, we're talking about one player. And we also were being quite honest about it and saying, you know, as in the media, and all media is like this, you kind of like having a new story to talk about every once in a while. However, that wasn't the only consideration for playing somebody like Garton. And now, of course, 2 weeks later, there is going to be an entirely new team being played in circumstances whereby the points actually matter. And we did bring up the point situation in the on the broadcast, simply because, you know, it's kind of, until you get down to the very end, as it was with the World Test Championship, most people aren't paying any attention to it whatsoever. So, you know, we put the table up, England away out in front, Sri Lanka in dire trouble of not qualifying, or at least not qualifying by right. And so, you know, it kind of matters, or at least it will matter further down the line somewhere.
It was one of the most depressing limited over series I think I've ever seen, that Sri Lanka run. It was horrific. You know, one of the all-time bad tours as well, obviously with the three lads breaking the bubble and going home. But England kept winning the toss and bowling first. And you could just sense the energy in the crowd just be sucked out of them before even a ball is bowled, because you know they're going to be 30 for four. And there is no stopping them being 30 for
but
four.
What was even worse,
and
though,
it was agony.
England still were really bad at taking middle over wickets. So they'd get them four down
God,
the power play.
You're a harsh judge.
No, but this contributed to why the games were so boring almost, because the games took so long to reach their conclusion. So England would get them four down.
And yet you knew what the conclusion was after 10
minutes. 5 minutes, yeah. So England would get them four down in the power play, struggle to get them all out whilst Sri Lanka kind of pod around going at 3.5, 4 and over.
I do wonder though, I mean, that was going to be my counter to the sort of like saying that they're not great at taking middle over wickets, was when a team basically goes into sort of four-day mode to try and rescue being four or five down in the middle, yeah. It becomes more difficult to prize them out. And so, you know, middle over wickets fall in matches where teams are trying to push on at sixes, sevens, eights, nines, but they're unlikely to fall when people are happy to pat it around at twos, you know what I mean? It kind of becomes, there's a stalemate there, whereas where the team bowling are totally in control of what's going on, they're not getting hurt, they don't have to kind of, you know, run in and try and knock you over with seven slips in the gully, because that's not the game, is it?
Yeah,
you know?
That's fair.
So, that's what happens. So you end up batting out the overs for 230, then you smash them off with 15 overs to go and everyone goes home.
Mm. Early. Forgets about it in minutes, seconds.
Phil, question for you. When England didn't go for the run chase at Lords in the Test match against New Zealand, some people said that England weren't reading the room, it's actually got fans back, entertained, etc. Do you think you could kind of make the same accusation to Morgan with the tosses? You know, you have crowds back for the first time, big crowds back for the first time in ages. It's been a difficult year, and you choose to win the bowl first every time.
I can understand the comparison, but I think the context is very different. And Morgan doesn't owe the fans anything, really. From a spectacle perspective, for sure, you know, and there is that frustration when the coin goes up and you know he's going to say, you know, we're going to bowl first and be home by 4:30. There is a frustration there, and yeah, sure, the crowd are looking forward to seeing England bat 50 overs and hit 350. But Morgan runs the show with absolute authority, and he's not in the business of of playing to the gallery.
Do you know what makes me laugh? Is that people quite sort of like with absolute sort of you know, open eyes were sort of saying to me, well, you know, maybe why didn't they just have a bat first under leaden skies in conditions that screamed bowl first? That the same people that were having a go saying, well, you can't just give any old person a cap. You know, you're basically replacing good players with good players. Maybe one change in a side. Don't do that. That's disrespecting the game. But batting first when you absolutely should bowl first is something that they should do just for a laugh. I mean, yeah. Come on, people.
Yeah.
What is this nonsense?
Yeah, but what we saw at Lord's...
Job is to win the match.
On that was a sort of embarrassing lack of personality, I thought, towards on that final day. And it was such a timorous refusal to live a little. And in that respect, I thought the criticisms were fair. And I felt it myself. And I was at that game at the time. I was really surprised to see the complete absence of intent. But in this instance, no. You know, they have a job to do. And they also had a football match to watch as well. And no question, one of those decisions was, right, we've got to get this done. We've got to get this done quick because it's kicking off at 5 o'clock.
I loved that.
No question.
Bairstow was probably on like the fastest half century by an Englishman ever as well. It's not been confirmed yet at the time of recording, but there are reports in Sri Lanka that Kusal Pereira has been removed as their limited overs captain, which I think is a bit harsh, but that's based off that
I bet Kusal Pereira is jumping up and down going, you beauty. Captain, wicketkeeper and opening batsman of that team. Yeah, it's all right. I'll lose one of those jobs, thanks.
You were saying, yes, that Banuka Rajapaksa was both banned for a year, suspended for 2 years, and recalled to the side in the same press release. Is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah. There are two paragraphs, one saying he's been banned for a year, but suspended. And the second paragraph is, but he's been called up to the latest squad, which is quite funny. Just after we recorded last week's show, India women beat England in the final game of that ODI series. Mitali Raj scored 75 not out in a last over win. Raj returns to the top of the ODI batting rankings for the first time in 16 years. I guess when England don't get 250, it's the perfect way to bat.
Well, I was the first time India had the chance to chase. And she made four half centuries. She's made four half centuries on the bounce now, Mitali Raj. And England lost their nerve a little bit twice in the game, I think. The first time was when they were batting, Amy Jones and Nat Siver. Although only going along at sort of 4.5 fives, pitch was very, very slow. And they had it all under control. They just needed to make sure that they got themselves to within 5 overs of the end before they tried to kind of break the shackles. Had they done that, they'd have made 240 and they'd have won the game easy. No danger at all. So they lost their nerve there, went too soon for the finish and ended up falling well short. And then they lost their nerve at the back end in the defence. You know, they ended up with 3 overs left of Sarah Glenn. Heather Knight had gone at sort of 3 and a bit, bowling her part-time offies, and Heather basically threw the ball to the seamers, so Nat Siver and Catherine Brunt for the last 5 or 6 overs, who both, you know, and sort of Mitali Raj played really, really nicely, actually. She kind of bopped a couple over the top, and kind of the Snehrana was able to knock the ball around and get it off the square. And you know, the run rate had only gone up to 7s, but that was the highest it had been at any point in the game. And the pace on the ball meant that they got home quite comfortably in the end. And so, Mitali, you know, I gave Mitali Raj the chance to kind of to have a pop back at the detractors for her...
Pointing at the 3 on the back.
For her 63 strike rate for the series. And to be fair to her, she didn't take it, actually. She sort of said, you know, I knew I needed to be there at the end, and if I did, we'd win the game. So, but, you know, I think England should have won it, honestly. And I think they kind of just tactically got it wrong twice and allowed India to get home.
It's been a positive story, though, the tour so far. 6-4.
3 T20s left, and, you know, the series is still on the line.
Yeah, it's been good.
And probably India's best format as well, T20s.
Yeah, indeed. And you know, it's a brilliant format that Claire Connor came up with a few years back, you know, to link the three formats together, and it works in this respect. And obviously there's some serious players to watch as well. You know, India are a very watchable side, and England are emerging. A word on Sophia Dunkley. She's got her own way of doing it. She's got quite a kind of idiosyncratic way of doing it. Hands quite separate on the bat handle, but that actually helps her manoeuvre the ball into funny areas, and she's got a really clean strike on her as well. And I like her a lot.
A proper strut in the field as well.
She does, yeah. She's got a bit of sass. She's great.
She reminds me a bit of Clive Lloyd, but that, you know, there'll be only be a few people listening to the pod who can remember what the cat looked like when he walked around the outfield.
Yeah, I generally can't think of the last England batter to look as at home as quickly as she has in international cricket. I mean,
I bet you can't remember the last time they gave one a debut. I mean, it's there's not been a great deal of new faces in and around that that top six for a long time. So,
On the format, as in the format of this this tour, this probably isn't the time to do it. But I would be interested in a serious discussion about that being replicated across women's cricket as a whole, as a way to get more countries playing Test cricket and possibly have it be in some sort of fully integrated league. I think it is a really good way for a tour to unfold, and I can see it working. And if that means that women's teams are playing, you know, four Test matches a year, say, that's obviously a huge uplift on what they are at the moment. But it's also not so much, and it's tied into everything else, I think. So I could see that working possibly, but as I say, I haven't thought through the details, but I would be interested to see a discussion about that.
Before we move on with the rest of the show, a plug for a few dinners that might be of interest to you. To celebrate the 40-year anniversary of Botham's Ashes, the Sporting Club are running four dinners over the course of the summer. The first one is at Edgbaston on August the 5th. All surviving members of the famous 1981 England team that won the epic fourth Test against Australia, including Botham, Boycott, Gower, Gooch, Gatting and captain Mike Brearley, will be in the room to recall another amazing victory snatched from the jaws of defeat, which saw Ian Botham take 5 wickets for 1 run in 11 balls. The second dinner is at Old Trafford on August the 19th. The fifth Test win will be celebrated at Old Trafford, featuring almost all of the England players involved. This was where Ian Botham smashed 118 off 102 balls, to many an innings that surpassed his 149 at Headingley, and Bob Willis did much of the rest. The other two events are at the Oval. To book tickets, head to thesportingclub.co/events. Anyway, on with the rest of the show. Some news about the 100. A number of big-name overseas players have pulled out this week. Aaron Finch, Nicholas Pooran, Shaheen Afridi, Alyssa Healy, Meg Lanning, and a few more. They pulled out citing either clashes with international commitments or complications relating to the schedule. The South African trio of Faf du Plessis, Imran Tahir, and Lungi Ngidi have been signed up as replacements for the men, while Shabnim Ismail and Laura Wolfart have joined the women's competition. The wild cards have been picked as well. The 8 are Ben Rain, Jordan Cox, Sam Cook, Jake Lintott, Fred Claassen, Blake Cullen, Leos De Plooy, and Dylan Pennington. Mostly quite a young group of players. Some exciting names there. We talked about a few of them last week. Ben, South Africa beat West Indies in the final T20I of that series to take the series 3-2. Slightly surprising result.
Yeah, a couple of things to work on for West Indies. Wasn't a high-scoring one. Pitches possibly maybe similar to what they'd be like in the UAE. I don't know. I watched a bit of the series, but I really enjoyed following it and got more into it as it went on. And actually, I think when you get a T20 series between two closely matched teams, actually 5 matches is the right amount. I think you do get storylines coming and going, like you got between England and India earlier this year. If the England-Sri Lanka series had been 5 T20s long, I think I'd have probably resigned on the spot. Just imagine having to do that while England are playing in the semis or something would just be but no, yeah, I thought it was really good. And actually, so what is there to take away from it? I thought the form of Bavuma was interesting in that he struggled and it seems like it's not really his best format, and they also don't really know how to fit him into the team. I can see why they like him as a captain. I think he's a calm head. There were some questionable captaincy decisions. They were trying to make Aidan Markram an all-rounder, which didn't really work, especially when some of the West Indies players are such brilliant hitters of spin, and he was bowling Reeza Hendricks in the first over a couple of times, and that was not a strategy that was working. But I can see why there's captaincy stuff to work with there. And in ODIs, he's obviously that Joe Root, Babar-Azam-esque accumulator that really fits in that team. In T20 cricket, it's less clear what his role is going to be. He's a good player of spin, so I can see it working in the middle overs. They were trying him as an opener, which is meaning that Aidan Markram was having to sit out and not open, and that was a bit that felt odd. Feels like Markram's natural position.
And Markram came back in, scored runs.
Yeah, and he'd hit 350s in a row, I think, against Pakistan before this series. So that's almost the main question for South Africa is how, I mean, Bavuma is going to be their captain for a while yet, you'd think. But how does he actually fit into that team as a batsman, and can he improve as a captain sort of tactically, if not as sort of a leader of men, which I think he will have nailed down. Because that's the other thing. I mean, you know, you can be beaten by West Indies before you get on the park, especially after that first game when West Indies just absolutely strolled it. Evan Lewis played a brilliant innings. That can be the kind of thing that sort of, you know, the series is over then. And for that, for South Africa to come back just as a unit, I guess, to regroup and then win three of the next four is very, very impressive. And that, and Bavuma does deserve credit for that. But that was quite interesting. And then,
well, I was going to say, West Indies are a lot of people's favourites, or right up there with the favourites. And I remember we did a T20 World Cup preview show almost exactly a year before the tournament was set to begin. And we're going through it, and South Africa's 11 looks very strong. And the performance of George Linder and Tabraiz Shamsi was very encouraging. They did really, really well. Their combined numbers over the course of the series were crazy.
Yeah, well, when you said it, Imran Tahir is not technically retired, as far as we can tell, from international cricket, and can't get a look in. I mean, it'll be interesting to see if he does tear up the 100 now that he's there as an overseas player, what effect that could have. But yeah, Tabraiz Shamsi is obviously left arm wrist spinner, been around for a while, but does look now like he's almost settled into that role as the attack leader as a spinner, they will cause a few teams worries, and they're in England's group, I think I'm right in saying. So yeah, they're one to watch. And yeah, West Indies, I mean, they just have a couple things to figure out. Like, there was Hetmyer was originally not in the squad, and then even when he wasn't in the squad, was somehow picked for the third game of the series and played all from then on. They've tried Gale at number three, which has worked for some T20 teams in franchise leagues, but hasn't worked so far in international cricket. So they've got a few little things to work on, West Indies. I think they'll still feel that if they can sort of, you know, get the band back together for the tournament, that they'll probably just about justify that favourites tag. But yeah, it's a shaping up to be a good T20 World Cup, I would say.
Evan Lewis has been opening in the T20s, you know, big sort of muscular southpaw, and he does, and he's been hitting them well. Probably their batsman of the five match series. And yeah, I mean, if Gale has had to be shunted down to first drop, then, you know, obviously Lewis is doing the business. And yeah, look, this is how they play, as we know. You know, they don't run singles, they hit it out of the park, and that's why they're the most dangerous T20 side in the world.
You do feel that surely Gale will go back up to the top of the order once the World Cup actually comes around, though, right? Like, I just think
it's marvellous that he's still there. I really do. You know, I always raise an eyebrow whenever I see him on a team sheet, because you never quite know from one week to the next whether he's up for it. But yeah, as Ben says, you know, they did it in the IPL relatively successfully. He was at three for the Kings 11, and maybe he'll stay there. I'm just delighted that he's there at all, as I say.
Made his international debut in 1999. 22 years ago. It's very long.
How old was Jude Bowman then? Minus six. he's even bowling a bit again now.
Yeah.
Which is amazing that he can still sort of get his arm over.
I always forget. 100 test matches, couple of triple hundreds, average 40 in the batting as well. Do it all. County Championship. James Anderson, he's quite good. He passed 1,000 first class wickets as he took career best figures of 7 for 19 against Kent at Old Trafford. Ben, you had a good stat about his battle with Darren Stevens and the rest of the Kent team.
Oh, yeah. So Darren Stevens hit him for something like 14 off 8 balls and obviously didn't get out. And against the rest of the Kent team, he took 7 for 5 or 55 balls. So it's, only the double vaxxed were doing it there. obviously Zach Crawley has now got an England call-up, so we won't see what the rest of that game or the next game would have done for him. But you just felt like after really, really struggling for the whole year in Test cricket, basically, and then playing some white ball stuff and doing pretty well, but obviously you're sort of that further out of your mind, to then, you know, cloudy skies, can't win the toss and choose to bat.
After a day and a half of rain
And then you walk out with James Anderson there, just at his absolute peak and just like,
and it was
completely
doing
fresh.
All yes. Sorts, yeah. As well. I saw the highlights. And he's done well to nick it, Zach, yes, to be fair. He's done very, very well. He must be in form.
There were quite a few balls that the batsman did pretty well to nick it.
It was the Jordan Cox ball, I think that was the second wicket, that was just absolutely ridiculous. sort of the one that sort of starts, like, it's looking like it's going to take leg time, just starts curving and then hits the pitch and then curves a little bit more and then takes the edge. And it's like, yeah, well, there's literally nothing you can do.
That's not sadness, but there's a poignancy to the 1,000 wickets. Can't see anyone ever doing that again.
We were looking at it the other day. Reckon your boy Harmer's going to do it.
Right.
He's
okay.
680. He's 32.
Okay. Yeah.
I think he's going to play enough cricket to be able to get there or thereabouts. Yeah, but we're looking at...
So, well, I'm thinking... No, hang on a sec. Does he play in the winters?
On that, I interviewed him last week. He is playing first-class cricket in South Africa from October and is very, very keen to see if the selectors want to have that conversation. As of now, they've not had any conversation at all. There's been no contact whatsoever.
So he could... I mean, he could... Say, for example, we put him down for 60 a season for Essex, right? That's reasonable, isn't it?
But below par for him.
Well, but just as an average, you know. So what's that? How many seasons of 60 has he got to go? Six seasons. That's just playing in England. So if he plays in South Africa, say you put him down for another 40.
Yeah.
So 100 a year. Yeah, he'd do it easy.
Yeah. Tim Murtagh's also stated his intentions to get the landmark. There was sort of, I think someone said, James Anderson, the last, has got to 1,000 and probably the last to ever get there. And Tim Murtagh just replied and just being like, challenge accepted, basically. He's the current closest, I think. Obviously, age isn't on his side, but if you look at, you know, some other bowlers, they can go well on.
What's he on?
840, 860, somewhere around there. So, and he only really plays, well, he only plays Middlesex now and is an overseas there. So he'd need to go for 3 or 4 years, I guess. Which is tough, yeah. But...
Irish first class cricket. That's
true.
Well into his 40s.
Yeah,
he's not going to do that, is he?
No, probably not.
No.
Uproot the family.
You just see him get to the 1,000. Like, yeah, well done. Well done, excellent.
Uproot the family from London. So I've got Jimmy to catch. So.
But your broad point is still true, though. Unlikely that, you know, the next English person to get there is possibly hasn't been born yet.
Yeah, and, you know, as we know, the game has moved on, priorities have changed, and so he is the last of his kind.
And also the first
the end of the line
as well. I think it might be the first fast bowler in the 21st century, so it does just emphasise again that his longevity has been, like, unprecedented in modern times and ridiculous, that it's that this isn't at all normal, basically.
First class wicket, do you know who it was?
Him?
Ian Ward.
Was it?
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
What was that, 2003? 2002.
You might have been playing that game.
Probably wasn't playing.
Okay.
I'm not sure I ever played against Jimmy in a first-class game.
Because he was playing for Burnley that summer, wasn't
really?
He was playing for Burnley, summer 2002, broke into Lank's team towards the end of the season, and then was on the one-day tour to Australia that winter, the 0-2-3 tour. And he, I think, maybe not his debut, but I think maybe his second or third game, he bowled 10 overs for about 30.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
So in Australia.
In Australia, yeah.
So when Wokes had that really economical spell against Sri Lanka.
Because Glenn Chappell always used to get me out when he played.
Right. Angle across, yeah.
Well, when Wokes took 5 maidens against Sri Lanka, that was the first time an England bowler had taken 5 maidens in ODI since Anderson on that tour as a 20-year-old.
Really?
Was it Adelaide?
I think so. I remember it being extremely hot. I think it might have been Adelaide. Always hot though.
But you kind of alluded to it earlier. Not a great round of games if you're an England opener or number three. I think Burns, Sibley, and Crawley got one run between the four of them.
two runs.
Compelling case for the first test against India.
And not a lot of cricket between now and then.
Oh, well, they've got two innings left, haven't they? Championship cricket between now and then.
Surrey got away with it, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely the story.
You haven't asked anybody for moments of the week yet. I don't think there is one. I think we should all just say that is it. Hashim Amla, Surrey batting out an entire day for what? For less than 100. How many did they end up with?
122 for 8.
122 for 8.
Marvellous.
Off 104.5 overs. So just going to read out some of the scores from this game. Hashim Amla, 37 not out of 278. Excellent. Oh,
That's so sexy.
I think this is more amazing. Keith Barker, 22 overs, 17 maidens, 3 for 9. That's ridiculous. An economy rate of 0.4 after bowling for pretty much a whole session.
I think it might have been Andrew Sampson that said that in innings where balls faced have been recorded, Amla's is the highest amount of balls faced for an innings of 40 or less.
Oh, excellent.
Just edging out Trevor Bailey's 38 off 277, I think.
The barnacle, yeah. Yeah, but he's got this kind of serenity, isn't he, to pull this off, and he's done it before. He did it for South Africa.
Well, yeah, this is in a way, I mean, the Hashim Amla story, even though this was a brilliant innings, it is winding down, I think. Well, obviously, he's retiring into cricket. This is most of the cricket he plays now is for Surrey, and he's been the occasional very good, very big innings, but also there have been sort of signs of that, you know, the eyes and hands going a bit. But this kind of...
Hasn't he strummed 200s at the Oval this year?
Yeah, the Oval. Everyone gets runs at the Oval. You get runs here. But this was almost a knock that was like reminded you of what made that South African side so great, because they just wouldn't get beaten at all. That first great series when they had was against Australia, when both those games they won, they were well behind the game. They chased 400 in the first, and the second they were 170 for seven, I think, replying to 300 and plenty, and then Steyn and Dumini put on like a 150 run stand. So that was like almost like the first sign of that Graham Smith instilled bloody mindedness. And then they did it in Adelaide, obviously, when Fatou Bassi made his debut. And then even when they just lost that away unbeaten record of series that had stretched for like just under 10 years against India in 2016, I think. So they'd lost the first two, or two of the first three on Bunsens. And then the third one, they were, I think it was India declared just before lunch, I think on the fourth day, saying South Africa about 400 to win, had no chance to get there, but they almost drew it.
That's right.
It was 143 off 143.1 overs. Amla, I think, was 25 off 244. AB, 43 off 280 balls or something. And that was basically what they did. They would just stick in games away from home for as long as possible. If they couldn't win it, they'd draw it. If they couldn't draw it, they would do their best to tire the opposition out, and then they'd take their chance when they came, basically. And that's what made them so brilliant and so like frustrating as an opposition to play against, I think.
So if you're a Hampshire fan, it's Graham Smith's fault.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Good.
Hasif Ahmed, 50-odd. Timely knock. Sorry, look, timely knock. 57 opening the batting in the championship, that's worth 130 in old
money.
Which
is why I was kind of giggling about him talking about Hashim Amla's eyes and hands going. Well, I mean, when the run scoring stocks of the country at an all-time low, I mean, just how bad is everybody else if a bloke who has no hands and no eyes is scoring all the runs that Amla is doing? Yeah. As I say, sorry, lads, you guys are really bad.
We made a really bad decision in the office. So we had the laptop books that you all use, the computer. We normally have a county game on just in the background. We looked at the scorecards at the start of the second session. We're like, oh, Hamid's batting. We'll watch that.
But we did consider watching Anderson bowling.
Oh yeah, we started watching Anderson because it's Anderson to Crawley. So look, we watched that. And then by the time we turned it on, Crawley was already out. We're like, okay, let's go to Hamid. And then we see the wickets go. It's like, oh, Anderson will surely come off soon. You know, they're not going to bowl him a long spell. And another wicket goes, and we just missed the whole thing.
I was watching Hamid. Obviously, I'm all in. Pathetic, kind of totally pathetic and superficial, but I'm all in. And he was brilliant, totally brilliant. Got a good one on 50 odd, but he set that win up for knots. All right, they're not playing a great side, it's fair to say. But timely runs again has to be a part of the conversation.
Yeah, we called him up early doors, didn't we? One of the first ones of these I did, saying,
yep,
he's got a great, great chance. I think he's very talented and, you know, has the goods, really, if he can turn that into some tangibles of making runs on a consistent basis. And he's done that. Well, again, you line that up against the run scoring feats of the rest of the country, and he's going pretty damn well. But what hang on, so the Surrey thing was extraordinary, right? But the rounds that we've got coming up in the next when is that last round of the
Sunday
County Championship? It starts Sunday, right? So you got Somerset play Surrey at the Oval, and Hampshire play Gloucestershire at Gloucester. So that's group two. The top four are all playing against each other in that round.
Gloucester look like they're going to beat Middlesex. That game's still going on.
If
they win that, they'll put them in the top two alongside Somerset.
Okay, which makes Surrey's chances very, very slim. But still, because they're playing against Somerset.
So it's basically between the top three in that group.
Yeah.
Group three's done and dusted.
Lancashire, Yorkshire.
A really good game between Yorkshire and Northants, by the way. Low scoring, spin friendly game. Best took career best figures of 743.
George Hill, youngster, made a brilliant 70-odd in the first innings when it was all sort of crumbling around him.
And then Brooke in the second innings dated exactly the same thing.
But that's done though, isn't it? Group three is over.
But it was only on that game, really, that confirmed it. And Northants have lost two real arse-nippers against Yorkshire this year. Yeah, they could have been top of this group.
Yeah.
On Brooke, he's scoring runs in all formats now. He's obviously been a name that people have known in the game, former England under-19 captain, etc. But he's starting to make good runs now in all the formats. So he's one to look for.
He was the PCA player of the month.
He has no shortage of self-confidence.
That is fair.
None. He's a pretty, he rates himself. And he's pretty bloody good too, to be fair.
And then in group one, it is still very, very tight at the top. Notts and Warwickshire are in the driving seat at the moment to qualify for Division One. Durham are close, and Essex with an outside chance. I don't think they're going to get it looking at the table.
But Durham play Notts in the last week at Durham.
Yeah.
And obviously Durham are going to be without Carr and Stokes that one. But if they win that, think they just about overtake Notts, they would overtake Notts.
Yeah. But Essex have got Derby away. So again, they'd back themselves to pick up points there, weather permitting, all the rest of it.
They need Worcester.
It's going to be really, really tight. Yeah, and Worcester play Warwickshire, don't they?
I think mathematically Essex can do it, but I think it's a very, very long shot now. Yeah. So between the three, really, I think.
So that Notts Durham game is going to be quite, quite exciting.
But amazing that one of them is possibly even both, but what one of those teams is definitely going to be in Division One though, given how both sides have been doing in Red Bull cricket in the last few years. Not just turnaround, it's amazing. They literally didn't win a game for nearly 3 years. Mm. They look a really good side at the moment. Elsewhere, something worth commenting on, there's a debut for a certain Josh Decares, son of Michael Atherton, in the Middlesex.
Athers went as well.
Oh really?
He went. Yeah. Despite himself, he went. And they won the toss and fielded, so he saw him get his cap and whatever, and then I think he vanished into the background when he found out they were fielding. But really nice moment.
Your moments of the week might have all been Amla, but mine's different. Mine's from a Glamorgan 2s versus Northants 2s game where Marnus Labuschagne, fresh out of isolation, needed to get back in some nick, and he found it. Labuschagne scored 276 off 268 balls. The Northamptonshire bowling attack featured a number of teenagers.
I find that a bit unsettling, a bit weird. Why would you keep going? How much do you love playing?
I just love the idea of Labuschagne getting to 200, take mark his guard again, like start again,
grinding him into the dirt.
It's the only way
they'll learn, right?
That would be a huge learning experience for them. But I actually think I have a different view on Marnus Labuschagne to most England-minded fans and pundits. Well, I find him really endearing, actually. Like, I love how much he just loves it. And I love that he would have just been, like, absolutely in his element there, just being like, this is absolutely great.
Probably being like annoyingly nice to the Northants bowlers as well. Yeah,
all well bowled. Yeah, all nearly nicked that one, is it? Like screams extra cover four.
Well, we were talking about that. There's a really good interview with Adam Holyoake on the Grey Cricketer podcast, and Holyoake's been Labuschagne's batting coach for the last few years at Queensland, and Holyoake was just saying Labuschagne just like follows him around and just talks about cricket and kind of at him.
Yeah, which I'd love that. He likes nothing better than constant cricket chat.
To finish off, we have a question from one of our listeners, Kat Knight. She asks, how does the team describe the England head coach's role in cricket compared to football? Gareth Southgate has been so talismanic for England football. Is there an equivalent in cricket? If not, why not?
Well, it's the captain, isn't it, in cricket? That's always the difference. The manager of the football team is kind of the boss, whereas I like to think that the captain of the cricket team is the boss. And so, the equivalent would be, I don't know, I suppose, Michael Vaughan in 2005 or Andrew Strauss getting that team to the top. The coaches in cricket are facilitators, and the best ones kind of, allow players to kind of make a lot of choices for themselves, whether that is bringing in outside coaches or, fitness guys, gurus of your own choosing, really. It's more of a delegatory role, I think, as a cricket manager.
I think as well, if you look at Owen Morgan and some of his statements over the years regarding what he wants his team to represent, I think there's parallels there with Southgate for sure. Yeah. There's a consciousness to both of those setups. You know, they don't just want to be sports teams. They don't just want to be role models. They want to stand for something over and above that. And if that can be confronting for certain people, then so be it. You know, and that takes a bit of courage, I think, because it's easy to say nothing, you know, and mind your P's and Q's. But both of those leaders have forged a story around their teams that goes beyond winning and losing and lifting cups and this, that and the other. So there's definite comparisons there, I think.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, not that we want to get too much into the football side of it, but I guess what Southgate is...
We don't mind.
What Southgate has sort of managed to do is you know, making them believe things that previously would have been, you know, huge psychological sort of chains around their necks, that those things can be sort of lifted. And I think he's done it by sort of being so embedded into English football and obviously been there himself, having missed a penalty over that, like, you know that he understands everything that you're feeling and thinking. So you know that every decision he takes is made with that, like, psychological weight in mind. Whereas when England have had foreign coach, maybe you can have felt that there wasn't that quite that same understanding of how much this all means sort of thing. And you look, obviously, there are parallels to England in ODI cricket with the 2019 World Cup, where, you know, there had been such, like, a litany of heartbreak that that sort of needed something to change to have that happen. And Owen Morgan did do a great deal of that, and especially with sort of the, you know, about the English team's identity and about saying, you know, Allah was with us after the World Cup final was a hugely poignant moment, sort of similarly to Southgate's letter about taking the knee before the tournament. But also, I think Trevor Bayliss, in a different sort of way, he's almost like, He pulled back the facade in a way of you know, tournament pressure and that sort of thing, and like being like, come on, let's just make a nice environment, let's just make something that means we can sort of play without that pressure, without thinking too much about that baggage.
I can boil it down also to something that's actually relevant to the playing of the game as opposed to the stuff that goes on around it. And in both cases, you've got in Owen Morgan in the One Day International team, and in Gareth Southgate with the football team. He very much believes that players should be told what their role is, how they're expected to fulfil it, and be picked to provide the service to that particular role. How many years did we watch England football teams who refused to pick left-sided players because they weren't one of Frank Lampard or Paul Scholes or Steven Gerrard? It was, we need to have these names in because they're the biggest names, but they don't actually fulfil the role that the team needs to fulfil. None of them play that way, but we'll play them all anyway and we'll see if it works. Whereas Gareth Southgate goes, well, you know, there's a whole left side of the pitch. Why don't we pick people who kick the ball with their left foot so we don't slow the game down by pulling inside all the time? You know, just stuff like that. We have a role, we have a way we want to play. We're going to base our game around possession football. Keeper's not going to get in his hands and boot it up the field so that it comes flying back at us twice as far. So we're going to get people who are comfortable doing this, and then we'll build around that. And I'm going to know what's happening with the under-15s, under-16s, under, you know, and bring everybody through playing the same way. Owen Morgan with the cricket team decided, right, we're not going to be timid. We're not going to play old-fashioned 50-over cricket. Therefore, I need to pick players who are comfortable going out there and trying to score 120 off the power play. I need bowlers that can take me wickets through the middle. And so you pick people who can do the things that, in a way that you want your team to play. There is your parallel.
Yeah,
you can't do any of those things if you're forever picking players who are not suited to doing the things you're asking them to do.
And if you Simples. Look at, around the 2015 World Cup, sort of the jettisoning before of Alistair Cook, obviously England's Test captain at the time, and then afterwards of Ian Bell, who I think was England's leading run scorer in that World Cup campaign, and I think he averaged more than 50 in the end. He got sort of a few big scores against some of the lesser teams, and was England's leading ODI run scorer at that point. And also James Anderson, obviously at that point probably their greatest ODI bowler. To get rid of those three players, that was, I guess, the sort of similar thing that we're picking based on what's best for the team rather than on reputation, as Butch says.
Well answered. That's all for today's show. Cheers, Phil. Cheers, Ben. Cheers, Mark. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends, and we'll be back next week. Cheers. Sports Social Podcast Network.